This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
In the untouched regions of the forest, the kōkako runs through the treetops feeding on leaves, flowers and fruit. The South Island kōkako, with its distinctive orange wattles at the base of the bill, hasn't been sighted in many years and may be extinct. A situation the blue-wattled bird of the North Island may find itself in unless its habitat is preserved. Its delightful call includes a variety of rich organ and bell-like notes.
Community or chaos, we can construct and nurture community or fall into chaos. Over the next hour, Marvin Hubbard hosts conversations toward creating a fairer, more equal society.
Community or Chaos is made possible with the support of Quakers Aotearoa. You'll find them online at quaker.org.nz.
Today, friends, we are talking with Stephen Zunis. And he's a professor of international relations at the University of San Francisco, specializing in the Middle Eastern politics, U.S. foreign policy, and strategic nonviolent action. Stephen, you're actually in Stockholm right now, aren't you? Sweden?
Gothenburg, actually.
Gothenburg,
yes,
sorry.
I'm a visiting research professor at the University of Gothenburg this semester.
Okay, how so? You like the weather better?
It's improving. It was pretty nasty when I arrived in January, and pretty dark as well. But it's been quite good. I have what they call the Torgny Segerstedt visiting professorship. It's named after this crusading liberal journalist from the early half of the 20th century.
We can use more of them.
This fellowship is through the sociology department here at the university. I was going to be focusing on pro-democracy struggles, but the situation in Gaza and U.S. policy has ended up taking most of my attention in my writing and public speaking since I got here.
Unfortunately, that's had the same effect on a lot of New Zealanders.
You
can podcast this by going to oar.org.nz, then going to podcast, then going to Community or Chaos. Stephen, has the war on Gaza possibly changed Middle Eastern politics and Israel's situation irreversibly?
I think in a lot of ways, primarily because it has really mobilized global civil society. And when we have seen global civil society mobilize, that's usually been the factor that has made the difference. We saw this in the downfall of apartheid, for example. We saw this, of course, in ending other foreign military occupations, such as Namibia, Timor-Leste. And once global civil society is mobilized, it makes it harder and harder for governments to continue the policies. Because in my long-term view is that Israelis aren't uniquely evil people. Israel is not uniquely bad. What enables Israel to do the horrible things they've done, a combination of which is uniquely bad, I would say, is because they get a blank check. From the United States, the most powerful country in the world, with the acquiescence of much of the rest of the Western world. I mean, if any other country had engaged in even a fraction of what Israel's been doing in terms of its violations of international law, they would be faced with international sanctions and other pressures that would force them to change their policies. But the United States has abused its veto power. I think last count, something like 47 times to block the UN from taking action. That doesn't even count the resolutions they allowed to pass that they weakened down or claimed or otherwise tried to subvert in terms of their implementation. Doesn't even mean the ones that they prevent from even coming up for a vote in the first place. And of course, the United States is providing the arms. that are responsible for the occupation, the funding for these arms, which enables Israel to use its funds for other aspects of the occupation. And of course, it leads the international judicial system, such as the International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice, impotent because they can only enforce their decisions through the cooperation of the United Nations Security Council, on which the United States has a veto. And I should mention, in every single one of these vetoes I've mentioned, the United States has been the only dissenting vote. So. But at the same time, there are some European countries that are still provide smaller amounts of arms to Israel, usually in the form of sales. And most European countries have normal trade relations. So it's not like, and this is true in New Zealand as well. So it's not like the United States is alone among Western nations in enabling Israel to get away with what it gets away with.
Actually, I suspect in some ways the World Court has not proved impotent because their rulings have affected the people who are questioning Israel. They've affected the protests, for instance.
Yes, I think there's a strong impression that a lot of these protests are led by people who have an ideological thing against Israel or Zionism or even pro Hamas, in any kind of movement you will have people who are the ideologues. I mean, obviously, for your listeners who've been around for more than a few decades, we know that solidarity movements with the global South have often, led to some of the more hardline leftists and others to, have a disproportionate visibility in the movement. But for example, those of us who, for example, opposed the war in Vietnam, intervention in Central America, were in the vast majority of us were not communist. We were not naive about the nature of the revolutionary opposition, but we realized that the forces that the United States and other Western nations were supporting, the brutal right-wing military dictatorships, the neocolonial systems that were being forcibly imposed upon the people there, were such that we were inspired to go out into the streets and to protest. And this is a similar thing with Israel and Palestine. The vast majority of people out there are doing so because they are concerned about any kinds of war crimes being committed by anybody, because they're concerned about any kinds of violations of international legal norms, including that you're not supposed to invade and occupy and colonize neighboring nations. So having the World Court there, confirming the illegality of these kinds of things, I think is an important reminder and an impetus, for those, who are to get involved. Again, not out of some kind of ideological preconceptions, but out of a simple belief in the post-World War II international legal system.
It amounts to ethnic cleansing, doesn't it?
Well, yes. I mean, I think obviously when Israel was created in 1948, about 85% of the indigenous Palestinian population was forced out either by fleeing the fighting or by a very calculated kind of ethnic cleansing, and in violation of international human rights laws, the refugees were not allowed to return. And there is a small scale ethnic cleansing going on in the West Bank, where the rampaging settlers backed by the U.S. backed Israeli occupation forces have forced thousands of Palestinians out of their homes, entire villages, including entire villages. We've had vineyards and olive orchards and others destroyed. So this has been going on for some time. And of course, what we've seen in Gaza, where the vast majority of the population have been forcibly moved from their homes. From refugee camps to refugee camps, only to find themselves, in the line of fire yet again. So this kind of ethnic cleansing is very much ongoing.
You know, even people who have in the past may have supported Israel are finding this not only unjustified, but quite impossible to ignore. Like the Jewish
very
community
true.
In Dunedin wrote a letter in support of the Palestinians.
I mean, you and I are of the generation that remembers when Israel was cool. I mean, where back in the 60s and 70s, a lot of young people, of our generation would volunteer to work in the kibbutzim. I mean, and not just Jews, but other people as well. These are these really cool, idealistic, socialist, agricultural collectives. Though, I mean, even then, most of them were on stolen land, but still, there was a, awareness of indigenous rights wasn't quite as high then as it is now. And Israel was a social democracy. They were fairly progressive on a whole lot of levels. And they were democratic, and they recognized women's rights, again, which is both of which are pretty rare in that part of the world. So there was this kind of idealistic view of Israel. And of course, this was magnified by the popular literature and culture. I mean, you think of Paul Newman in Exodus, and it made it look like, in many ways, in hindsight, it looks like one of those old westerns, the brave pioneers fighting the savages. There's certainly a racist undercurrent there as well. But in any case, there's a very idealistic view of Israel. Conservatives actually were not into Israel. I mean, they wanted good relations with the oil-rich Arab states, and a lot of them were anti-Semitic, and they didn't like the fact that Israel was so progressive in a lot of ways. But things have really changed now. I mean, not only is Israel no longer a social democracy, but it's gone very, very, very right wing on so many levels, much more overtly racist than it was under the Labor Zionist leadership previously. And I think also just attitudes about nationalism have shifted. And I think this is one reason there's such a big gap between younger people and older people regarding Israel. I mean, many of us, even those of us who are critical of some Israeli policies, nevertheless saw Zionism as a national liberation movement for an oppressed people. And like any national liberation movement, they'd have progressive and reactionary currents. But basically we saw it as a good thing. But now younger nationalism is seen more like the nationalism of Eastern Europe, very racist and very reactionary and indeed, the Israel under Netanyahu is much closer to Hungary's Orbán's Hungary than it was to Olaf Palme's Sweden, and so that's really that, and not surprisingly, that's why the biggest boosters of Israel nowadays do come from the right, and the liberals and social democrats and the more traditional pro-Israel people are becoming more and more skeptical, and of course the horrors of what we've seen in the past 7 months have only solidified that growing opposition.
People like myself, I was born during the war. I was the Holocaust affected lots of families in ways they couldn't ignore. And that was probably the main reasons so many people supported Israel in the beginning.
Yes.
Yet, what we've seen in Gaza is past ethnic cleansing. It feels to me.
Yes, it does. It does meet the international legal definition of genocide, which is broader than the more popular understanding, which is somewhat unusual. I mean, there have been other comparable genocides in what we've seen, and we're seeing in Burma right now with the Rohingya, with the in Darfur and in Serbia, but for that matter, what both the Iraqi and Turkish regimes have done to the Kurds, what the Pakistanis did in Bangladesh in 1971, what the Guatemalan junta did in highlands with indigenous people in the 1980s, and for that matter, what the United States did with the Free Fire Zones in LF-controlled areas in South Vietnam, and of course the carpet bombing in North Vietnamese cities. And Israel, by that definition, certainly what Israel is undergoing is a genocide. But you know, I think the guilt from the Holocaust doesn't really carry as much weight as it did. You know, the guilt of the West, you know, not reacting sooner and preventing it. But even then, I mean, the idea that the Palestinians had to suffer for the crimes of the Europeans, you know, has never seemed mm-hmm. right. But let's remember, the genocide against the Jews by Hitler is as far back in history for today's university students as the Belgian genocide was in the Congo for you and me. And so, you know, it definitely puts a different perspective on it.
I know a family in 68, I think it was about 68 or 69, they were going to send their kids to kibbutz. They were Jewish. And then they did some research and they decided they wouldn't because of they even then started to see it as a form of colonialism or a form of taking land that wasn't theirs.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's quite insightful for that period because there were not a lot.
I was quite surprised at the time. They were certainly more insightful than I was at that moment in time.
Yes. And again, I think a lot of us, you know, fell into that kind of liberal mythology. But in many ways, I mean, it's comparable to what a lot of leftists have about, you know, socialist revolution, the third world, that on one level we want to see it succeed so badly that, you know, sometimes there's a tendency to, and because some of the criticisms of these socialist revolutions are so unfair and so hypocritical and are motivated by imperialism, a lot of people on the left get defensive. So today, for example, you hear people, you know, some leftists trying to defend Maduro in Venezuela or Ortega in Nicaragua, despite all the horrible things they're doing, you know, because they are trying to defend the ideal rather than the reality. And, you know, they recognize, you know, the hypocrisy and double standards of imperialist countries and criticizing them. Well, that's the way a lot of people feel about Israel. You know, that they're looking at the ideal instead of what Israel's actually become. And because some of their criticism of Israel really is motivated by anti-Semitism, because there really are some double standards out there, that kind of adds to the defensiveness.
Accusing people of being anti-Semitic because they're anti-Israel or even anti-Zionist is a kind of false accusation, isn't it, if that's the only...
Yeah.
I think
anti-Semitism has been weaponized.
The former leader of the Labour Party in England, he may have made mistakes, but I don't think he was an extreme anti-Semitic like he was painted by the people who wanted to get rid of him. It's become a way of, it's a part of politics now.
Yeah, yes. And I mean, it's complicated on a number of levels. First of all, no one can say, you know, they're not anti-Semitic any more than one can say they're not sexist or they're not racist. I mean, anti-Semitism, like racism, sexism, other forms of oppression are ubiquitous. But the fact that, you know, that the fact is that the vast majority of people who criticize Israel are doing so, you know, they criticize for any other country doing the same sort of thing. But the anti-Semitic charges have resonance because, again, it impacts a lot of people on the left liberal end of the spectrum that might otherwise reject, say, charges of communism or something to, you know, somebody on the left who opposes a, you know, particular government or policy. Because there's an assumption among many of us is that, you know, If a black person says something is racist or a woman says something is sexist, who are we as white men to say, oh, it's not? You know, I mean, the default assumption is that the person in the target group should know better, right? But unfortunately, and when it comes to Israel, people have disingenuously used that to excuse for this repressive right-wing government. And that makes it and so that's led a lot of well-meaning people, well-meaning non-Jews who maybe left the center to react and assume it must be true because someone in the target group is saying it, and end up censoring or denying or denying people the right to speak, or otherwise suppressing suppressing free speech.
What's going
I
to
should also point
happen
out.
to Raphael, the city in the south?
Sorry?
What's going to happen to,
Rafa?
Rafa?
All right, let me just finish one more point on this, though, on the anti-Semitic thing before moving to that, though. Anti-Semitism, like racism and sexism, can have its more subtle manifestations, what some people call microaggressions or whatever. And so it's something we really do need to be careful. We don't want to have a crying wolf phenomenon where the false accusations of anti-Semitism makes us unaware of where it might really exist within the pro-Palestinian movement. And just one example is that I think there's often an exaggerated view of the power of the pro-Israel lobby or Zionist Jews in terms of the policies of the United States and other governments. But when you look at the reality is the United States and the Western governments have supported all sorts of nasty regimes doing a lot of nasty things. And in a lot of ways, Israel is not that different. Most of the genocides I listed earlier were backed by Western governments. And the fact is that we need to often people will blame the Israel lobby or powerful Jewish interests, and they'll exaggerate Jewish financial power in ways that parallel historic anti-Semitism, which exaggerates Jewish power in finance and in media and in government and that kind of thing. So we have to be really, really careful about that, and not use anti-Semitism to cover for the underlying racism and imperialist motivations that are ultimately behind the Western support for Israel.
The
On to Rafa, go ahead.
it seems to me there's a contradiction in the right-wing movements in America that support Israel, yet many of them are also anti-Semitic.
Oh, very much so. I mean, the Republican Party has cozied up to neo-Nazis and all sorts of things, and they turn around and they accuse student activists and others for anti-Semitism. It's the whole pattern about Trump, the most corrupt president in U.S. history, claiming that Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden are the corrupt ones, and saying that the mainstream media is the fake news, whereas Fox News or whatever is telling the truth. I mean, it's the same kind of thing, just throw back, whatever's being thrown at them. But the crazy thing is, in the United States at least, and you see pockets of this in New Zealand and elsewhere, that you do have these right-wing Christian fundamentalists, these evangelicals who have this kind of millennialist theology, where the ingathering of the Jews to the Holy Land is necessary for the second coming of Christ. And rebuilding the Second Temple, have Israel, control, that entire area is necessary for Christ's return. And to them, the Israelis versus the Palestinians is Israelites versus the Philistines, and we know whose side God is on.
What?
And these folks, of course, the crazy thing about this is part of this theology is that when Christ does come, all the Jews will be condemned to eternal damnation. They want the Jews for Act One, not Act Two. But anyway, that's also a factor in
Let's
the
go
whole
back to
story.
Rafa, I think.
Well, Rafah, I mean, this is the tiny enclave in the south western corner of Gaza, where the vast majority of Palestinians have been forced out of their homes destroyed, have been put into that little corner there, are now being told to move yet again, and Israel's started
They don't have any
bombing.
place to move.
No, really, and they'd say there's a safe zone amid the rubble, about 10, 10, 12, 15 kilometers to the north, east. But, you know, they're still bombing. They bombed a tent city just last night, killing over 31 people. You know, Biden said he would stop all offensive military aid to Israel if they went ahead and did this. They're doing it. He lied once again. He's not doing it. The International Court of Justice just a few days ago ended up putting on an injunction, you know, saying that you cannot engage in this kind of full-scale offensive and force the removal of people and bomb civilian areas. Israel's defying this. Again, the United States is blocking the international community from upholding the World Court's order. This is an incredible human tragedy unfolding before our eyes, and it's been coming for months. But Netanyahu knows that, you know, the U.S. and the rest of the world will do some finger wagging, say you can't do this. But as we've seen before, they have refused to do so.
Well, I might play some music now and then we'll come back. Well, that was from the best of Mimi and Richard Fairme from the back in the 60s, but I think that song is still appropriate, unfortunately. You can podcast this by going to oar.org and then going to Community or Chaos and podcast. We're talking with Professor Stephen Zunis of International Relations, who specializes in Middle Eastern politics and also strategic nonviolence. How do you see the immediate future of Israel and the present government in Israel?
Well, here's a big problem. I mean, it's easy to blame everything on Netanyahu. He is so corrupt, he is so extreme, et cetera. But the unfortunate reality is that Israeli politics is moving inexorably to the right. Part of it is because they have not had to suffer consequences for their actions. It has encouraged the more hawkish people and discouraged the more peace-oriented people because the Israelis feel they can get away with stuff. But also it's simply demographic that the conservative, orthodox, ultra-nationalist Israelis tend to have big families. The more secular, you know, progressive, peace-oriented Israelis tend to have small families. And it doesn't take, and given that most, not everyone, of course, but most children follow the politics of their parents, that it doesn't take long in a small country like Israel for that to have an impact. Not to mention the fact that it seems like half of my Israeli friends who tend to be leftist have at least one child who's emigrated to Europe at this point, you know, so, you know, because things have gotten so bad there. I mean, things have, they're really, the far right really, and the right wing have really come to dominate. I can't imagine any possible coalition government in Israel being willing to accept a viable Palestinian state alongside Israel. And again, the U.S. has shown has been willing to shield Israel from any kind of accountability. So I don't see, you know, much change in the near future. I mean, I think the biggest shift for a lot of us, I mean, I've been pushing for a two-state solution for more than 45 years. But, you know, my last couple of visits to the West Bank, I mean, the colonization, you know, by the Israelis is so complete, you know, that, it's surrounded all the population centers. It really is an apartheid system. I mean, that's not hyperbole. Definitely meets the international legal definition of apartheid. It's not like, it's not like a half a million of these Israeli settlers are going to move back to Israel.
Well, not voluntarily.
Yeah. And
Ireland had a civil war over something like this back in when they made a compromise peace with Great Britain in 1918. Yeah. The they decided to let Northern Irish Protestants control Northern Ireland and have a separate state. And they did it because they wanted peace. They wanted an end.
Yeah.
And they had to have, yep. They had a minor civil war over it.
Yeah, well, the problem is that, you know, in Ireland, the vast, you know, good 85% of the Irish people, you know, and pretty much everybody, right? But the Protestants in the northeastern part of the country, you know, wanted their freedom from British colonialism. But, you know, Israelis are, you know, Israeli Jews are the majority or close to the majority. You know, this is not terrain that's ideally suited for civil war or anything like that. It's only going to be international pressure that I think will make Israel shift, because you know you can't. You know, armed struggle isn't going to work. You know, terrorism is not only morally wrong, but politically counterproductive. Nonviolent struggle. I'm a big fan of nonviolent struggle, as you know, and we've seen how it's nonviolent resistance has ended occupation in everywhere from India to the Baltic republics. That also needs, you know, when you're a minority in your own country, you know, it's hard to make progress there. And international efforts like boycotts, divestment, and sanctions, I mean, that's actively discouraged. In fact, it's even made illegal in parts of the United States to advocate that. So, you know, basically the Western world has said, you know, you can't, we're going to rule out all the possible ways of getting your freedom. I mean, this is Biden's position. He says, you know, we will not condition military aid to put any pressure on Israel to compromise. We'll block the United Nations from doing so. We'll veto Palestinian membership in the United Nations while just encouraging Arab countries to unilaterally recognize Israel. You know, we will.
But South Africa may be more popular right now than the United States.
Yeah. But you know, basically what the Biden administration doing is they're ruling out every avenue the Palestinians can have for statehood. They say they can only be statehood through bilateral negotiations with the Israelis, ignoring the fact that there have not been any bilateral relations negotiations since 2015, and that the Israeli government categorically rules out having any kind of Palestinian state. So frankly, Biden is lying when he says he supports a two-state solution. Because you can't say you support a two-state solution, then block every possible avenue for that to come about. And so that's why global civil society is important. That's why global civil society comes in. I think it would be really great, for example, if New Zealand, you know, could join Sweden and Ireland and Iceland and Spain and Norway and 140 other countries around the world, and recognize Palestine as well as Israel. I mean, you know, I understand the New Zealand government supports a two-state solution. If that's the case, then recognize both states. And the more countries see Palestine as a state, and this is under the Palestine Authority, based in Ramallah, led by Fatah and the PLO, that have renounced armed struggle, that recognize Israel's right to exist in 78% of historic Palestine. I mean, these are the moderates. Hamas and the Israeli government are the extremes. The Palestine Authority, the recognized state of Palestine, recognized by 143 countries, they're the moderates in the equation, even though they are really corrupt and inept and a lot of other things. But, you know, if New Zealand could recognize them along with all these other countries, that would be an important that would be an important step forward along with other governments.
It seems to me if you can only have two states if the settlers actually withdraw. I mean, you can't to have two states, you need some territory that's autonomous and that you decide what you're going to do with it.
Yeah, I suppose you could work out a situation where the settlers could stay as Israeli citizens, but be subjected to the laws of the state of Palestine. And for that matter, Arab citizens of Israel could become, you know, citizens of the state of Palestine, again, as long as they, you know, obeyed Israeli laws. And there are provisions that both Palestinian and Israeli laws would be completely non-discriminatory. You know, and no discrimination on the basis of a religion or ethnicity. So you could see a situation, you know, like that emerge. But whatever it is, whether it be a democratic secular state from the river to the sea, as some people are advocating, whether it be a two-state solution in the traditional sense or something in between, like I was just describing, it has to be based on the principle of equality. And that's what the Israeli government and its supporters in Washington refuse to agree with. And of course, that's also, of course, what Hamas and Iran and people, those on the other extremes, are refused to recognize as well. But that's the bottom line here, is equality. Because we know from history, if people are denied equal rights, especially in their own land, you know, there's going to be resistance. And sometimes that resistance is going to be nasty and include terrorism, and that's wrong. But it's inevitable unless, you know, their people's basic rights are recognized.
It strikes me that in the United States, the right-wing Christianity is actually degrading the ethics of Jesus and the ethical foundations of Christianity. Is Israel doing the same thing to the foundations of Jewish ethics?
Oh, very, very much so. And that's why what we've seen in the United States is that a disproportionate number of the student activists at these encampments at American universities have been Jewish. And some of the more militant actions you may have heard about, the blocking of bridges, rail stations, highways, these have been led by Jewish groups like If Not Now and Jewish Voice for Peace. And you know they chant the slogan "Not in my name," that they really, really are horrified at what's going on, and you know and this idea that you know Israel is the is a manifestation of Jewishness, that you can't separate Israel from Jewishness. They're saying no, Israel is a nation state. Israel is a false idol. Israel is a golden calf. You know, Israel is a golden calf. This is not what being Jewish is about. It is indeed contrary to this 5,000-year-old ethical tradition.
How do you see this working out in American democratic politics?
Oh boy!
The threat is both what's happening in Israel, but also what can happen in the United States. And
you know, well, it's got me worried. Biden's, let me tell you why. And that is that Biden's policies is contrary to the views of the vast majority of Democrats, over 70% of whom, you know, support a ceasefire. Close to 85% of young Democrats. Similarly large majorities want to suspend offensive military aid to Israel. 56% of Democrats believe what's going on is a genocide. And yet their president and their congressional leaders in both the House and the Senate, and indeed 80% of Democrats in Congress, support unconditional military aid, oppose a ceasefire, do not believe this is genocide. I mean, I'm hard-pressed to think of a single issue, even going back to the Vietnam War, where there is such a gap between ordinary rank-and-file Democrats and their party. And what happens when there's a gap between people and their party in an election year? People don't vote. Or even if they do vote, they don't campaign or contribute money like they would otherwise. In a close election, that could be huge. Look, young voters are very, very important. Young voters vote overwhelmingly Democrat, 60% or more. Years when there's high youth turnout, Democrats win. When it's low, they lose. And I know so many young people, a whole bunch of my students, two of my three kids, their friends, They're saying, I ain't voting for genocide, Joe. The young people's opposition to Biden's policies in Israel-Palestine is like 80%. And that is higher than youth opposition to Bush's policies in Iraq, Reagan's policies in Central America, and even Nixon's policies in Vietnam.
Well,
and
I lived in America. I don't know how I could vote for him.
I mean, 20%. Polls in the swing states, 20% of Democratic-leaning voters say Biden's policy makes them less likely to vote for him. And remember, with this crazy electoral college system we have in the United States, even though Biden will almost certainly win a majority of the popular vote, if the election were held today, he would lose. Trump would become president. And this and this is what's going to be like 1968 all over again. And to top it off, in addition to opposition to an unpopular war in the Democratic base, protests all over campuses, guess where the convention, Democratic convention is this year? Chicago.
Sorry. Well,
I mean, and I'm seriously, so just to underscore what I'm saying is, you know, one of the more tragic outcomes of what we've been seeing
is Trump getting reelected.
Israel's war on Gaza and U.S. support for it is not just the Palestinians that are going to get hurt. If things don't change, it's going to make Trump president again, and the manifestations of the United States and the world are hard to imagine.
Do people? It's too late for Biden to withdraw from the candidacy, isn't it?
He could always say, for health reasons or whatever, and it could be an open convention, and the delegates could choose a new candidate. There are some elders in the party, Obama or somebody could say, hey, Joe, there's too much at stake here. Maybe you need to step aside. But the problem is that most of the leading contenders, including Vice President Harris, have been supporting Biden's policy towards Gaza as well. And
what about somebody so, like Elizabeth
just like
Warren?
Hubert Humphrey, just like Hubert Humphrey replaced Lyndon Johnson, it didn't stop the election of Nixon, November.
Or all the Democrats outside of Bernie Sanders supporting Biden?
Oh, no, there have been a fair amount. Elizabeth Warren, Chris Van Hollen, and some of the governors. I mean, Kathy Whitmire, for example, might have a decent policy that she hasn't spoken out much. She has a large Arab American population in Michigan. It's not hopeless. But actually, one of the good things is, I mentioned that poll at 20% said that makes them less likely to vote for Biden. That same poll showed that if Biden changes policy, that he was able to get to pressure Israel for a ceasefire, and he suspended military to Israel, that would make 40% of people more likely to vote for him. So it's not too late for Biden to do the right thing. Whether he'll do that or not, that's another question.
Well, yeah. What's the future of genuine rules-based international order that's somewhat sane?
Yeah, it's a hard one. Clearly the Russian invasion of Ukraine is a big challenge to that. Though frankly, with Biden saying we have to defend the rules-based international order, no country can bomb civilians, no country can change its territory by force. Well, he supports not just the Israeli occupation, but the Moroccan occupation of Western Sahara as well. In fact, the United States is the only country besides Israel to formally recognize Morocco's illegal annexation of that nation, which is an independent state recognized by a member of the African Union. It's pretty appalling that the United States has long seen as a leader in upholding the rule of law. And yet, we are supporting these outlaw nations like Israel and Morocco.
Well, what should countries like New Zealand do? Should we join AUKUS and support American foreign policy because America's been offering in the past?
I think I don't. There is reasonable concern, I think, about ambitions of countries like Russia and China. One can see why a country might want to be part of some kind of alliance like that, but except for the fact that the United States is not upholding these values either. And as long as the United States, until the United States, really supports democracy, the United States, 58% of the world's dictatorships get arms from the United States right now. Until the United States really supports democracy, until it really supports international law that's not just opposing Russian aggression in Ukraine and demanding a withdrawal, but demanding Israel and Morocco withdraw as well. I mean, until the United States actually lives up to what it claims to believe in, I don't think New Zealand or any other country should be part of an alliance, because otherwise it's just old-fashioned rival geopolitics, you know, the kind of alliance-based systems, you know, that have ended up in global war, and not a values-based, legal-based, law-based system, you know, that could really maintain a just world order.
Should nations like New Zealand and South Africa actually support getting rid of the veto?
Unfortunately, it's a dilemma where you can't to pass UN reform. It has to be passed by the Security Council, and the veto wielding powers to use their veto, so they wouldn't give up their veto. But at the same time, small nations like New Zealand, can play an important role, as New Zealand has in terms of creating a nuclear-free Pacific. We remember that struggle. They got a lot of pressure from the United States on that, but held firm.
Reason why people question whether we should join AUKUS is because
exactly. The nuclear question is a big one. Also, the when New Zealand was on the Security Council a few years ago, New Zealand actually challenged the Western support for Morocco when they expelled most of the UN civilian peacekeepers from Western Sahara, authoring resolutions that unfortunately the U.S. forced to water down. But that principled stance from a pro-Western nation like New Zealand did have some impact on that debate. And, again, I think recognition of Palestine would be huge, and actually recognition of Western Sahara. That would also be big, as so many other nations, have done. So, New Zealand can play a disproportionate role in its size, because New Zealand doesn't have a lot of enemies. A lot of people respect New Zealand.
Do the
and I think having a taking the, and it's also, of course, very much in the advantage of small countries like New Zealand to support a strong international legal order.
Okay.
Because, that's the best thing going for you. Your armed forces aren't going to, are too small to protect you if there's a genuine threat. But, a law-based order, is indeed your best defense.
Do the Democratic Party realize that they have to change Biden's course?
I think there's people are kind of oblivious. It really shocks me. I mean, I think people are used to the idea that you could go as far to the right on Israel and Palestine as you wanted, and it wouldn't hurt you politically. But this political calculus has changed dramatically. And I just think that Biden and a lot of other people haven't got the memo. And so, it's not pressure from the pro-Israel lobby on the presidential level. The contributions from pro-Israel elements are pittance compared to the overall, hundreds of millions of dollars it takes to run a presidential campaign. But I think Biden is just caught in this real ideological commitment to Israel. That's quite rigid. And also, he's never been a big fan of international law anyway. I mean, he was among the right-wing minority of Democrats who supported the invasion of Iraq, for example. But the Democratic Party's changing, and especially its youth wing. The College Democrats, which is the youth wing of the party, they've come out very strongly against Biden's policies in Israel-Palestine. They've endorsed the the student protests and the like. So change is coming. In fact, I've never seen any issue besides maybe LGBTQ issues where there's such a gap between younger and older Americans. I mean, it's practically a straight line. The younger, the older you are, the more pro-Israel you are. The younger you are, the more pro-Palestinian, or at least pro-peace. So, you know, change is coming, but unfortunately, I don't see it coming with this administration.
Well, let's hope you're wrong, because I can't see how Biden can get reelected unless he changes.
Yeah, exactly.
And I can't see, well, the idea of Trump being president again is frightening, even if you live in New Zealand.
Yes.
Well, thanks a lot for coming on, and keep up the good work.
Thank you, and it was great talking with you again.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.